Hello, you're listening to Law and Borders, the podcast that looks at the differences between English laws and those of other jurisdictions in the United Kingdom. I'm Jess Harold, and today I am joined by Anne Stewart, a senior professional support lawyer at Shepherd and Wedderburn LLP, to discuss the differences in energy efficiency provisions between England and Scotland. There is a similar commitment between the English and Scottish governments to improving the energy efficiency of buildings in the UK, but the way in which they've gone about tackling the issue is different. So perhaps we can look at Scotland first. The Climate Change Scotland Act 2009 is the main governing legislation. So how does that apply?
Yes, that's right. The 2009 Act is the principal legislation affecting commercial buildings in Scotland at the moment, although I should mention that the Energy Act 2011 also applies to Scotland. That's the legislation under which the minimum energy efficiency standards regulations in England have been made. And there are similar provisions that apply to Scotland, although in our case, Scottish ministers have got a discretion about whether or not to use them. And so instead, they've used Section 63 of the Climate Change Scotland Act to regulate the position in Scotland for commercial buildings or building units. So it covers for commercial buildings or building units. So it covers self-contained parts of a building, of a larger building, but units of a floor area of more than 1,000 square metres. And the requirements there are triggered on the sale of a building or on the grant of a new lease. So two triggers for these requirements. And what happens is that the owner has to prepare an action plan. An action plan is kind of capital A, capital P for the purposes of these regulations. That sets a program for the implementation of measures to improve the energy performance of the building and reduce emissions of greenhouse gases produced by it. And they have to get a qualified Section 63 advisor who has to carry out an assessment of the energy performance of the building. Then he prepares this action plan, which has to specify any identified improvement measures for the building. And these are measures that are taken from a prescribed list, which it would be practicable to carry out in the building. And they include things like installing draft proofing, insulation, upgrading lighting or heating controls, or low energy lighting, and in some cases, replacing an elderly boiler.
So you mentioned energy performance, but how does the energy performance certificate process work as part of that procedure under the 2009 Act?
Well, in fact, the action plan is kind of a turbocharged energy performance certificate, if you like. So if the building doesn't have an EPC, then it still has to get one. But for these larger buildings, the Section 63 advisor uses the energy performance data from the EPC to prepare the action plan. So it sort of takes the recommendations in an EPC a step further.
So to maybe go into a little bit more detail about these action plans, there's a requirement stipulated in the Act that all sales or lettings of property over 1,000 square metres must have an action plan in place. So what does that look like in practice?
Right. So as well as setting out these identified improvement measures, the ones that are prescribed in legislation that I've mentioned, the action plan has to include targets. You know, it's actually, you know, something has to be done here. It's not just a piece of paper like an EPC tends to be. So it includes an energy performance target that the building has to meet in a set period of time. And it also sets an emissions target for the building. And these are targets that have to be reached over a set period of time to improve the energy performance of the building and reduce its emissions. So actual improvement and reduction has to take place. The actual improvement measures that the Section 63 advisor recommends have to be carried out. And they're also set out in the action plan. Now, the measures have to be cost effective and proportionate. So it is possible that the Section 63 advisor will say, specify alternative improvement measures that could be used by the owner to achieve the same emissions reduction instead of these prescribed improvement measures, or the work carried out can be a combination of both. So there's an element of flexibility in how you actually achieve these energy performance and emissions targets. Those actual building improvements, the ones that are set out for this particular building, must, once they're completed, reduce the energy consumption of the building to meet the energy performance target, and reduce the emissions from the building to meet the emissions target. So, you know, there's a set path mm-hmm. laid out in the action plan.
So how does it work in practice in relation to building improvements?
Well, it varies, to be absolutely honest. It's usually a matter for the owner and the Section 63 advisor to get together, discuss the findings, and agree the approach when the action plan's actually been prepared. And of course, the trigger for these action plans is that the building is about to be sold or mm-hmm. it's about to be let. So clearly needs to be some kind of discussion there with the purchaser or the prospective tenant, since they're going to be in possession of the building or in occupation of the building when this work is actually carried out. Now, usually, there's no hard and fast rule, but usually a purchaser will either want the improvements to be carried out at the seller's expense before they buy, or they might seek a price reduction to cover the cost of any improvement works that need to be done. For let property, most landlords will probably want the tenants to have some kind of responsibility. Whether total responsibility for the works or not is, again, really a matter of negotiation on the terms of the lease. What the landlord has to ensure is that the lease terms allow them to take access to the property for the purposes of carrying out these works if they are going to retain responsibility for doing that. Where building improvement measures are specified in the action plan, there is a time limit. Mm-hmm. They have to be carried out within 3.5 years of the action plan. So depending on the nature of them, you know, it might be something that happens over a phased period of time, or they might simply be something that is you know, done towards the end of the 3.5 year period. Very much depends on what's involved. There is, though, Jess, an alternative option mm-hmm. to having any building improvements carried out at all. Instead of carrying out any improvement works, a building owner can actually make arrangements instead to just measure, report, and display the operational ratings for the building, and he has to do that on an annual basis. The operational rating of a building, just to explain what that means, is it's a numerical indicator of the energy consumption associated with the actual use of the building. And so implementing operational ratings measures involves obviously gathering data, assessing and recording the energy consumption associated with the building's use. And then you have to send the results to the EPC register, and the results for the previous 12 months have to be displayed in a display energy certificate for the relevant year, and that has to be in a prominent place in the building. Where these operational ratings options are chosen, then the Section 63 advisor can prepare an advisory report, and that gives advice on cost-effective, technically feasible recommendations to improve the energy performance of the building and reduce the emissions. So even although there's not actually a requirement to carry out work, the intention is still to improve energy performance and reduce emissions. And that might include recommendations for building energy management measures, upgrading building services, or using low and zero carbon technologies, for example. Mm-hmm. So this reporting option it's not a do nothing option, but it can mean that there isn't actually a requirement to spend lots of money on physical improvements to the building. So, you know, that it's an attractive option for, mm-hmm. for a lot of sellers and landlords. And of course, if the property is being let, then again, in terms of, you know, what you put in your lease, the landlord has to make sure that the tenant's obliged to produce the data for these operational ratings.
Okay, and are there any exemptions that apply to this process?
Well, yes, there are quite a few, actually. Mm-hmm. Some buildings, of course, are already sufficiently energy efficient, so they don't need an action plan. The exemptions will include buildings, for example, which have installed Green Deal measures, mm-hmm. If anybody has done that. If they did have a Green Deal plan, that would mean that, in effect, they already had an EPC and an action plan, so they would be exempt. Also, buildings constructed to reasonably recent building standards. In Scotland, we've had several since, but the 2002 building standards are the marker for that. So if they meet those standards because of the time of construction, or if they've been retrofitted to meet those standards, then again, they're already sufficiently energy efficient, so they don't need to comply. Okay. There are other exemptions, such as temporary buildings, which are only intended to be used for a couple of years, workshops, non-residential agricultural buildings that have got low energy demand, standalone buildings with a total useful floor area of less than 50 square metres, so tiny little buildings. Also, if it's a renewal of a lease, brand new lease, but to the same tenant, that's exempt. Buildings that have not yet been constructed are exempt as well. And short leases, so talking about a lease for a period of not more than 16 weeks, those kind of leases are exempt as well.
Okay, so let's then turn to England and Wales, and the where the system is governed by the Energy Act 2011 and the Minimum Energy Efficiency Standards, or MEES. So could you just outline for us how they operate?
Well, it's quite a different approach in England and Wales because the MEES regulations actually impose a physical ban on letting a substandard property until improvement works have actually been carried out. So in Scotland, you can go in, you can do your works, but it doesn't prevent you from selling or letting. In England and Wales, you are prevented from letting.
Well, that's obviously a very major difference.
Well, quite, yeah, considerable. And it sets this energy performance sort of minimum threshold, you know, the ABCDE energy indicators. It's got to be E or above for the landlord to be able to let the property. So anything below an E is there's a ban on letting until it's brought up to standard. And that has been in place since the 1st of April 2018.
And certain properties are excluded, but could you sort of list what some of those are?
Well, buildings with an energy performance indicator of E or above are excluded, obviously. So that does make a difference. Although the minimum rating threshold will, I think, be raised in due course, because we've got a UK government consultation at the moment looking at long-term trajectory for energy performance of non-domestic buildings. And they are suggesting aiming for a mandatory B rating, which is quite a leap for buildings by 2030. Again, that's just at the consultation stage. And I think the idea is that instead of having a staged progression, it gives landlords a long period of time to get to B, rather than constantly having to meet incremental targets on the way. However, that is yet to be finalised. There are other excluded categories, which and basically it's properties that don't require under an EPC under the EPC regulations. So again, quite similar to the ones I've just listed for the Scottish regulations, although listed buildings and places of worship are also excluded from the MEES regulations, and also leases of 6 months or less and a tenancy of term certain of 99 years or more.
Right. Okay. So and there are some additional deadlines coming up to the ones that you mentioned, including April 2020, which will broaden the application of the MEES regime. Can you talk us through some of those?
Right. So at the moment, the MEES regulations only apply to new tenancies and lease renewals. However, it will be extended to all other commercial tenancies from April 2023. That's even where a lease has been in place for some time and there's a tenant in occupation. For domestic tenancies, 1st April 2020 is the deadline for improving the property rating to E as a minimum, if the landlord wants to continue to let it under the existing tenancy, or indeed to let to a new tenant. So there's going to be a lot more current leases that will come within the ambit of these regulations over the next 2 or 3 years.
So are there any other pending regulations to be aware of in Scotland?
Yes, there's quite a lot going on, actually. So far, as I think you'll have seen, it's only commercial properties that have been affected by these regulations in Scotland. Both commercial and domestic properties are affected by the MEES regulations in England. However, We're not going to get away with it for much longer because there are new regulations expected to come into force in Scotland in April 2020, which will affect the residential letting sector. Mm-hmm. And these, in fact, are being made under the Energy Act 2011, the discretionary powers that I mentioned. And they will be similar to the Mies regulations in that they will prohibit the letting of substandard property. So very familiar, from 1st April 2020, any new tenancy will require the property to have an EPC of at least band E, and by 31st March 2022, all let properties will need to have an EPC of at least band E.
Shortly after recording, the final version of the regulations Anne refers to was published, which introduced a period of grace, so the requirement not to let unless the property meets the minimum standard will not now apply until October 2020. Now, let's continue with the further details.
And then there are to be incremental increases in the rating threshold, so that from April 2022, any new tenancy will require the property to have an EPC of at least band D, and so on, probably in sort of, you know, 2-3 year chunks as properties are gradually required to improve. And Scottish Government's also currently consulting on similar energy efficiency standards regulations for owner-occupied homes. So the expectation is that that will impose a minimum rating level as well. So we're moving, you know, closer towards the sort of Mies approach rather than the Section 63 approach that affects commercial property. The trigger for owner-occupied homes is likely to be when the property is sold or transferred to a new owner, possibly also when major refurbishment work is undertaking. Now, that consultation is running at the moment until the end of March, so there's still plenty of time for parties to make their views known. And at the moment, in terms of introduction, they're talking about probably 2024 for that one coming on stream.
So you've given us a nice overview of how the two regimes work, and while there are clearly similar aims with both of them, they operate quite differently in practice. So what advice would you offer to landlords who hold property both north and south of the border to avoid getting tripped up?
Well, it's very easy to get confused. Yes. And of course, there are penalties for failures to comply, so it's very important to be aware if you can. We find that many clients used to operating south of the border are unaware that there's a different regime for commercial properties in Scotland. They should certainly check with their lawyer, preferably one like Shepherd and Wedderburn, who is familiar with both the Scottish and the English regimes, or with their surveyor at an early stage. It's fair to say that their lawyer and their surveyor, hopefully knowledgeable, should be flagging this up to them at an early stage, particularly before they're committed to the terms of the lease, which might, you know, inadvertently prevent them from complying if they haven't got the necessary, you know, ability, for example, to enter the premises. So it really helps to engage with the tenants as well, have the conversation about how to make the most energy efficient use of the property and help to reduce emissions in the building. And there's a lot of things that landlords and tenants can do on an ongoing basis to improve the energy performance of the building. And of course, both parties benefit from that. The Better Buildings Partnership Green Lease Toolkit, which I think a lot of your readers will be familiar with, and it's available online, of course, is still, in my opinion, it's one of the best resources for helping landlords and tenants to become more energy efficient. It, you know, contains lots of cost-effective ways to improve energy performance of your building. And, you know, I think it's quite clear that these days it's more and more imperative that everybody needs to be doing what they can do to reduce emissions and help to combat climate change.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for joining me and discussing how these two regimes operate, Anne.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You have been listening to Law and Borders from EG.